In celebration, here you go. Wow. Can Kanye be my friend?
The only one that hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the garden that Sijo Zechariah and his father planted was a way to make sure their family had food to eat during the coronavirus pandemic. But the garden became much more. It became a way to help their community. It also led Zechariah to change the direction of his life. The 22-year-old aircraft engineer had been living in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. But he was in the southwestern Indian state of Kerala for a family wedding when the government shut down the area as the coronavirus spread. What's going to happen, he thought. You know, how are we going to feed ourselves? Food stores in the area were nearly empty. Places that sold plants for gardening were closed. So Zechariah and his father collected seeds from whatever fruits and vegetables they could find and planted them on their family's land. They already had some plants growing, but they added many more. The father and son watched YouTube videos to learn about gardening. They also remembered information that Zechariah's grandfather had passed down to his father. Over time, the garden would help feed 20 other families during the pandemic. We started teaching others how to grow their own crops so that everyone can have some sort of crop growing in the land, he said. Kerala's climate is tropical. That means it has a lot of rain and sun, making farming easier. Zechariah became interested in permaculture, a movement that says farming should work with nature instead of trying to control the land. In the past, Zechariah had studied and worked in Wales in Britain. He wondered why the food he ate in Wales was better than the food he ate at home. Zechariah came to understand that the food was fresher. It came from local farms and was not treated with chemicals before traveling by truck or plane to be sold far away. Zechariah is now considering a new profession. Farming. He connected with other people online who are thinking of a future in farming as well. He said, "There's many people like me who are genuinely curious or genuinely want to do something, but they are stuck somewhere, with their work or in a city life." Zechariah has left the farm in the hands of his neighbors since returning to Dubai. He has decided to become a farmer. "It's a big change for me, but this is what makes me happy, helping others and being in nature," he said. There is one more reason he was happy with his farming life. "I was getting quality time with my dad as well, so it was like a win-win," he said.
More American schools are rethinking the ways they teach The History of Thanksgiving. Students often learn that the holiday dates back to 1621, when English settlers in the present-day United States shared a Thanksgiving meal with Native Americans. But in some schools, teachings about the history of this major U.S. holiday have become more complex. Lessons now include issues of conflict and injustice. They also include greater attention to the people who lived on the land long before European settlers arrived and named it New England. Schools in New England and other places are beginning to hear more about what some experts call hard history, shameful events of the past. The students may still learn about the meal that is said to have taken place in 1621, but they also learn that relations between white settlers and Native Americans were uneasy, and they learn about the resulting years of conflict. Language arts teacher Susanna Remillard had noticed that her sixth grade students had been taught much more about the English settlers than the Wampanoag people, the Native Americans who sat down with them to eat. She said she now tries to add more balance to her lessons. We carry this colonial view of how we teach, and now we have a moment to step outside that and think about whether that is harmful for kids and if there isn't a better way, said Remillard, who teaches at Cape Cod Lighthouse Charter School in East Harwich, Massachusetts. Arlington Public Schools near Boston, Massachusetts, is working to expand its lessons on Native Americans. This includes pointing out what educators and other experts call Thanksgiving myths, untrue stories and ideas. Students as young as 5 years old learn that harvest feasts and Thanksgiving were part of Wampanoag life long before 1621. They are also taught that the early settlers, known as Pilgrims, and the Wampanoag were not friends. School officials believe it is important to unlearn false ideas about the Thanksgiving holiday feast. We don't want the coloring books of the Pilgrims and the Native Americans, said Crystal Power, a social studies teacher with Arlington Public Schools. We want students to engage with what really happened, with who lived here first, and to understand that there was no such thing as the New World. Groups that support Native American education welcome the recent wave of action at schools in Massachusetts and other states. But they also say that progress has been slow and uneven. Schools in many places, they say, still teach insensitive, outdated lessons. Progress seems to be gaining momentum, but there's still a lot of work to do, said Ed Shupman. He oversees Native Knowledge 360, the national education effort at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. He is also a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation of Oklahoma. Shupman and the museum have worked with states as they create new lessons on Native American cultures. Some states now require schools to teach such histories. Even in states where such lessons are not required, however, classrooms are becoming more inclusive. School officials say they are not changing history, but adding parts that have been left out. Usual social studies school books have included little about Native Americans, and classroom materials that included more about Native Americans were hard to find. Teachers say that is changing, thanks to Native experts who have written children's books, lesson plans, and other materials. I'm Katie Weaver.
Scientists have created a new app designed to identify dangerous mosquitoes based on sounds the insects make. The app, called A Buzz, is aimed at helping fight major diseases spread by mosquitoes. The diseases, such as malaria, dengue fever, and yellow fever, kill hundreds of thousands of people each year. Harapriya Vaidehi Narayanan is one of the researchers who helped develop the app. She began work on the project as a graduate student at Stanford University. She is now with the Department of Immunology at the University of California, Los Angeles. Narayanan told VOA that anyone with a mobile phone could use the app to identify mosquitoes. If they see a mosquito around, they just open the phone, open up the app, point their phone towards the mosquito, and hit the record button, she said. Then, when the mosquito flaps its wings and starts flying around, it makes that noise, that annoying buzzing noise. That noise is what gets recorded by the A Buzz app, she added. Many diseases that mosquitoes carry do not have cures or vaccines. So targeting the flying insects is the best way to control them. The most important step is to know where the mosquitoes are, Narayanan said. Traditional methods for hunting mosquitoes are costly and can take a very long time. The process also requires labor-intensive trapping as well as trained scientists to identify the insects. Manu Prakash is a professor of bioengineering at Stanford University and a lead investigator on the project. He says that out of about 3,500 different mosquito species, only about 40 are dangerous to humans. Prakash says the goal of the project was to find out whether the mosquitoes around a person's house are just an annoyance or whether they are possibly dangerous. To find out, his team decided to listen. When mosquitoes move their wings up and down, they produce buzzing sounds. But each kind of mosquito makes a somewhat different buzzing noise. The app records these sounds. Users of the app can get an answer by recording as little as 1 or 2 seconds of the buzzing sound. The app compares this recording to a collection of other recordings. It then predicts which species of mosquito it is most likely to be. Billions of people around the world can use this tool with their phones. So, the researchers say they will be able to monitor mosquitoes on a much larger basis than in the past. By crowdsourcing mosquito information worldwide, the app can help build maps of where dangerous mosquitoes are. This can help scientists and health officials identify areas where disease is likely to break out and where to target mosquito control. Prakash said he believes this kind of widespread community effort can be an important step in fighting mosquito-causing diseases. He added that the tool uses machine learning to get better as more people use it. So we're very excited that if hundreds of thousands of people are recording mosquitoes every day, especially around the world, it will create the kind of community that is needed, Prakash said. The development team is expected to release the Abuzz app to the public in the coming months. Another group of researchers at the University of Oxford in Britain has been developing a similar app called Mozware. That app is designed to identify malaria mosquitoes by the sound they make. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Surrender finally came for General Robert E. Lee and the Confederacy he had served as a great soldier. It was mostly his military skill and intelligence that kept the South in the field so long. But even his extraordinary skill could not save the South from the industrial power of the North and its mighty armies, armies that were well-fed and well-equipped. Stuart Spencer and Leo Scully continue the story of the American Civil War.
The last chapter of the bitter four-year struggle came in April 1865. General Grant had pushed Lee's army away from Richmond and nearby Petersburg, Virginia. His Union forces had kept after the Confederates for almost a week. Lee fled westward across Virginia. His tired, hungry soldiers tried to turn south, to reach safety in the Carolinas. But always, the Union Army blocked the way. Finally, on Saturday, April 8th, Lee's army found it could flee no farther. A Union force at Appomattox Station blocked any further movement to the west. Early the next morning, Lee tried to break through the ring of Union soldiers that surrounded his army, but he failed. Nothing was left, nothing but surrender.
Lee sent a note to General Grant, asking to meet with him to discuss surrender terms. A few hours later, General Grant rode into the crossroads village of Appomattox Courthouse. General Lee was waiting for him at the home of a man named Wilmer McLean. Lee rose as Grant walked into the house. Grant did not look like a great military leader, the chief of all Union armies. He was dressed simply. His clothes were the same as those worn by the lowest soldiers in his army. His boots and pants were covered with mud. His blue coat was dirty and wrinkled. But on its shoulders were the three gold stars of the Union's highest general.
Lee was dressed in his finest clothing. He wore a beautiful gray coat with a red sash tied around it. At his side, he carried an ivory and silver sword. The two generals greeted each other and shook hands. Grant said, "I met you once before, General Lee, while we were serving in Mexico. I have always remembered your appearance. I think I would have recognized you anywhere." Lee said, "Yes, I know I met you then, and I have often tried to remember how you looked, but I have never been able to remember a single feature."
Grant continued to talk of their service in the Mexican War. He said later that he did so because he was finding it difficult to bring up the question of surrender. Lee took part in the light talk for several minutes. Finally, he said, "I suppose, General Grant, that the purpose of our meeting is fully understood. I asked to see you to learn upon what terms you would receive the surrender of my army." Grant answered, "The terms I propose are those I offered in my earlier note to you. That is, the officers and men surrendered will not take up arms again, and all your weapons and supplies will become captured property."
Lee said those were the conditions he had expected. He asked Grant to put the terms in writing so he could sign them. "Very well," said Grant. "I will write them out." It took him several minutes to write the surrender agreement. Only once did he look up. He had just written the sentence, "The arms, artillery, and public property will be given over to the Union Army." Grant stopped writing and looked over at the sword the old general wore. He decided there was no need to hurt Lee's pride by taking away his sword. So he added, "This will not include the sidearms of the officers, nor their horses, or other private property. Each officer and man shall be allowed to return to his home. He will not be disturbed by United States authorities as long as he honors this agreement and obeys the laws where he lives."
Grant gave the paper to Lee. Lee read it slowly. When he finished, Grant asked if the Confederate general wished to propose any changes. Lee was silent for a moment. "There is one thing," he said. "The cavalrymen and artillerymen in our army own their own horses. I would like to understand if these men will be allowed to keep their horses." "You will find," Grant said, "that the terms as written do not allow it. Only the officers are permitted to take their private property." "You are correct," said Lee. "I see the terms do not allow it. That is clear."
Until now, Lee's face had shown no emotion. But for a moment, his self-control weakened. Grant could see how badly Lee wanted this. "Well," said Grant, "I did not know that any private soldiers owned their horses. But I think that this will be the last battle of the war. I sincerely hope so. I think that the surrender of this army will be followed soon by that of all the others. I take it that most of your soldiers are small farmers and will need the horses to put in a crop that will carry themselves and their families through the next winter. I will not change the terms as they are written, but I will tell my officers to let all the men who claim to own a horse or mule take the animals home with them to work their little farms." Lee was pleased with this. He told Grant, "This will have the best possible effect upon the men. It will be very gratifying and will do much to help our people." While waiting for the surrender papers to be copied, Grant presented Lee to the other Union officers in the room. Lee had known some of them before the war. After a few minutes, Lee turned to Grant. He told him that his army held about 1,000 Union soldiers as war prisoners. He said that for the past few days, he had no food but cracked corn to give them. He said he had nothing to give his own men to eat. Grant called in his supply officer and ordered him to feed the Confederate army. He told him to send to Lee's army enough food for 25,000 men.
Finally, the surrender papers were ready. Grant and Lee signed them. Lee shook hands with Grant and walked out of the house. Lee got on his horse and rode slowly back to his army. As he entered Confederate lines, men began to cheer, but the cheering died when the soldiers saw the pain and sorrow in Lee's face. Tears filled the old man's eyes. He could not speak. Soldiers removed their hats and watched silently as Lee rode past. Many wept.
A crowd of soldiers waited at Lee's headquarters. They pushed close around him, trying to touch him, trying to shake his hand. Lee began to speak. "Boys, I have done the best I could for you. Go home now, and if you make as good citizens as you have soldiers, you will do well. I shall always be proud of you. Goodbye, and God bless you all." From the crowd came a loud cry. "Farewell, General Lee. I wish for your sake and mine that every damned Yankee on earth was sunk 10 miles in hell."
On the other side of the lines, Union soldiers began to celebrate. Artillerymen fired their guns to salute the victory over Lee. Grant heard the artillery booming and sent orders that it should stop. "The rebels are our countrymen again," he said. "We can best show our joy by refusing to celebrate their downfall."
General Grant left Appomattox Courthouse to return to his headquarters a few kilometers away. Suddenly, he stopped his horse. He had forgotten to tell President Lincoln or War Secretary Stanton that Lee had surrendered. He sat down at the side of the road and wrote a telegram to Secretary Stanton. News of the surrender reached Washington late on Sunday. Most citizens in the capital did not learn of it until early the next morning. Then cannons began to boom out over the city. Crowds rushed to the White House to cheer the president. They asked Lincoln to make a victory speech. Lincoln said he had not prepared a statement. He wished to wait until the next night. He asked the people to come back then, and he would have something to say.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.